I'd like to just take a few minutes to thank everyone who took the time to come to the opening of the central collection of the Digital Historical Collection this afternoon. And I thought I'd start by giving you a little bit of background on how this collection was conceived and started. Somebody told me what to say. I don't know if I'm supposed to say this or not, but I'm going to give you my version instead of what was written up for me. I was walking one day outside of the lobby of ML12, and Ken Olson was walking toward me, and I forgot to make a quick right and turn. So he said, hey, how would you like to put together a collection of all the things that digital's made, both the good things and the bad, for posterity, so that people in the company, our employees in the company, can take a look at it and learn from some of the things that we've done in the past and understand where the company's come from and where it's going. And I thought that was a very unique and very interesting project. And the more I got involved in it, the more enthusiastic I got about the project, because it really seemed to me to be something that was very important, something important for us to have and to preserve. And you know, some of the things we made in the early days are scarce now. There aren't very many of them around. And if we didn't do a collection like this, some of them would be lost forever. So I was very proud to work on this project. My name is Gary Eichhorn. I'm the manager of the Laboratory Data Products Group. I'm located on the fourth floor of this building, and that's why I've been involved in it. Been involved in it now for about 9 months. And there were a couple of key goals we had for the central collection. One of the goals was to make sure that all the employees in the company were involved in the historical collection for the company, not just a handful of people. And in fact, if you walk around and you look at the collection, lots of employees have already been involved in donating pieces and have been very enthusiastic about working with us on designing this collection. And the second goal was to make sure that we didn't have just one collection here in MR2, but in fact we had a collection that spanned all the locations of the company. And I'll talk to you a little bit about how we were able to accomplish that. Now, the first thing we had to do when we decided to have a historical collection is to form a committee. That's the first thing you do when you have any job to do. So we formed a committee. And the committee consisted of people around the company from many of the engineering groups. And the first thing we did after we formed the committee was we developed an architecture. That's also the first thing you do when you form a committee at Digital. And so we now have the distributed collection architecture for Digital Equipment Corporation, which this committee developed. And the idea behind it is you're here in the central collection, but there are also going to be collections all over the company in the individual engineering buildings. And these will be in the lobbies of the engineering buildings. They will be developed by the engineers in those buildings, and they will show the history of the products that are being built in that engineering building. So over time, you'll see collections in the various buildings around the greater Maynard area, and in fact, you'll see collections in locations around the world, engineering buildings that are building particular products. Now, this collection is an opportunity for you to sort of see a glimpse of everything, not a lot of detail on any one thing. For example, there's PDP 1120 located here, but if you want to see the history of the PDP 11 family, you can go to some of the engineering buildings that built PDP 11s and see a much more extensive collection of the PDP 11. So that's basically what we're trying to accomplish here. It's the beginning of what we hope will be a company-wide effort to preserve our history, to learn from our history. And we have a number of thank yous today in being able to develop this central collection for the historical collection. The MIT Lincoln Laboratories photo library was used for some of the photos that you see around, as was the MITRE photo library. At Digital, there were a lot of people involved in putting this collection together, including media services. It's too late to redesign that one, I think. The photo department, the library, the purchasing organization, the legal department, plant engineering, the facilities organization, which I think has done a magnificent job, and a security organization, which helped us put this whole thing together, and the lobby was in quite a disarray for quite a period of time, and they helped make sure everything worked smoothly. In addition, the Jeff Kennedy Associates team were the people who are actually responsible for the design And F.W. Dixon was responsible for the fabrication, and I think you can see the outstanding job that those folks did in being able to implement this collection. And there are some people who were very much involved in this collection I'd like to give some special recognition. Jim Fleming, who was the group personnel manager for LDP and is now most recently the central Maynard facilities personnel manager, managed this project for me for 9 months. Janice Moore from the Media Services Organization did most of the design and layout and made sure everything came together. Ron Smart has been helping from a corporate point of view to get everybody excited and keep things together. John Trebendis has been the man behind the scenes, making sure all this heavy equipment got into the right place in the right time and stored professionally. And I'd like to especially thank the person who was ultimately responsible for this project, who could not be here with us today because this is apparently going to be a dual opening. It's the opening of the historical collection, and it's also the birth of, I believe, a child for the person who really managed this whole project, and that's Jamie Pearson. Jamie Pearson is, I think, in labor this minute, trying to remember this day for more than one reason. And she really is the person who put so much effort, so much energy into making this collection what it is today, and really, I think, has done just a tremendous job. Now, before Ken speaks, I'd also like to, we're very pleased today to have a guest with us to say a few words. I'd like to introduce Joe Cashin. Joe is the executive director of the Computer Museum. The Computer Museum has worked with us in making sure that they supported us fully in this project, and we're very pleased to have Joe here to say a few words. Joe?
Thank you, Gary. And I'm pleased to be here this afternoon representing the Computer Museum. We at the Computer Museum really applaud this effort of Digital's. We think that it's a very appropriate thing to do. We'd like other companies around the industry to do even more of this. We think it's important, as Gary pointed out, as an opportunity for people to see, you know, where a business and products have come from and where they're going. And I think there's a lot to be learned from it. I personally am enjoying it. I'm old enough to have been around when a lot of these things were done. And so I get an extra kick out of seeing these things and bringing back memories that they had for me at the time they were done. We were pleased to work with Digital on this effort and cooperate in any way we could, and we think they've done a terrific job. Gary said this was a low-budget operation. Boy, I wish we had budgeted Computer Museum to do some exhibits like this, and it was a tremendous job, and I wish you all luck with it. Thank you.
Thank you. That was very nice of you. It's very important that we keep our goals straight. We're not in competition with the museum. This is strictly a historical digital museum or collection, and we want to make sure that we always do that, and we always encourage and help the museum. We, through our early years, knew we weren't documenting things for posterity. We knew we weren't taking pictures, but we were just so busy making things. Then, for years, we said we were going to build a museum. We saved space in the middle of PK2 20-some years ago. That was going to be our museum. And when it was done, we had so much business we had to use the space. Then we went through cycles of being hard up for business and we couldn't afford a museum, or so busy that we didn't have time for the museum. When we built PK3, that huge building on Parker Street, we set aside generous space there for the museum. Before it was done, we had to use it for computers. We also suffered because we didn't know what we wanted to do with it. Gordon Bell and I secretly were only interested in keeping dusty old collections of things that we like to remember. Other people wanted to make it a teaching museum, and we know we could get it straight. Nothing really got going until Gwen Bell grabbed hold of it and ran. and there was no argument. She just ran, and the museum grew out of that. And it developed quite nicely here. Then it became clear that the world needed a computer museum much broader than digitals. And so we developed a board of directors, largely of outside people, and made an industry museum. Then moved it to Boston so that it would break its ties with digital to encourage all the other members of the industry to take part in it. It still suffers a little bit from people believing it's a digital museum, but we try hard. I don't take part in the meetings, and I think take my name off finally, just so that we wouldn't, just so that it wouldn't like a digital museum, be a digital museum, and their goals are much broader than ours. Meanwhile, it became clear that we should save pieces from our history, document them, put them aside. But we're still missing the equivalent of Gwen Bell. And it wasn't until our leader here grabbed hold of the thing and ran, and now we have what we have here today. And it always takes somebody to drive something and get it done. And so we're very proud of you, Gary. somewhere. I walked through the other building and saw them reassembling tens and twenties, and I must admit it looked strange to me. When I walked in here, some of the stuff looked like I never saw it before. But in studying it, I have a lot of memories. And maybe you'd like to hear a few stories. Maybe I'll indulge in something that I don't think you've ever heard me do before, which is to tell my part of some of the things. Yeah, I'm not paid to invent and do. I'm paid to get others to do it. And the worst thing I can do is brag about anything I did. So that's not what we're here for. What I'm here for, I'm to get others to do the work. But back in history, I might tell you a few things. When I walked into Whirlwind, I didn't know what a computer was. Whirlwind was a classified military project. Nobody on the campus at MIT knew what it was. We had no idea what a computer was. And they were very well organized. Bob Everett, now director of ours, and Jay Forrester, professor at MIT, ran the place with great discipline and great organization, and they had a lot of informality. And their idea of how to run an organization is what inspired us to run digital. A lot of freedom, a lot of trust, yet discipline, and enormous intellectual drive and high productivity. One of the things they did to you when you walked in that place would give you a 2-week indoctrination period. It was like being a neophyte in a religious order. You see, they had a 10,000 tube computer built of vacuum tubes that had a 500-hour life. That computes to a relatively unreliable machine. And they had almost a religious way of treating vacuum tubes. You had to obey these rules, and it was almost ritual. They never turned the computer on. They cycled it up very slowly so there was no thermal shock. Everything was derated, and when we took apart one of the Sage computers, which was even further development, some of the tubes, I think, were 20 years old and still working. And they were designed for 500 hours. First job I had was to redo a diode switch. On the top of that memory, there's 4 diode switches. Now it's hard to imagine how naive the world was in those days. They built a diode switch in 3 dimensions because that's the way it was drawn. It was a 3-dimension strung wires with diodes soldered in them. And I figured out how to do them all on one plane without printed circuit board. Next job I did was to make the D to A converter. You see, Whirlwind was really the first personal computer. It was 3 times as big as this room. The racks are 11 feet high and about that wide, and there was 1 for each digit, 16 digits wide plus something on the end, and about 4 rows of them. And it smelled of ozone. The voltages were high. And the room was darkened, and all those filaments glowing red. and some of the tubes were glowing blue. Some were supposed to, and some weren't supposed to. It was really an awesome room to walk into it, and cool down. So when you just had that feeling of awe. And I decided that one of my design criteria for computers was what I call the Canyon effect. The computer had to be higher than a man in order to be impressive. And it was very reluctantly that we made one shorter. You see, this one had to fit through a door, but it was really high to be impressive. I had, and I'm not sure that memory has it, but somewhere you see some other things I designed where there was power control in the first 30 inches, and everything you worked at was convenient stand-up height. No one else ever thought of that since then. Whirlwind was really a personal computer. It was 16 bits long, which was ridiculed by the world. Many of them were up to 64 bits. It was very fast and very simple. The strategy for building a computer was to make very complex circuits, thoroughly designed, tested to every degree, with a lot of parts in there, optimized, and then make very simple logic. This was just opposite from what the rest of the world was doing. The rest of the world made very simple circuits and then very complex logic in order to compensate for it. Bob Everett used to joke that every computer had 10,000 tubes. Whirlwind took 10,000 tubes to just make it work. Others made simple computers with simple parts, kept adding tubes and to gain more speed, and they all leveled off at 10,000. It was something in people's minds that 10,000 was as much as you could do. The Whirlwind computer had drums, which is equivalent to the discs we have today, had 3/4-inch tape from Raytheon with concentric reels and a little unit, and had a cathode ray tube, which we had light pens and a joystick. Didn't have a mouse. It also had audio and played music. In fact, every computer we built for a number of years had audio. We couldn't conceive of it. And a cathode ray tube. We couldn't conceive of a computer without a cathode ray tube and without sound. I mean, you couldn't tell it was working unless you could hear it. But you see, it was interactive and was a computer. And it was out of that came the inspiration to make digital. It was interactive. And interactive computing is the message we wanted to bring to the world. MIT, and in particular the computer lab, was really very generous and trusting. And a real experience, and you see many of the things we try to accomplish came from there. One of the things they did in this military project, off the campus a little ways, in a low red brick building, they would allow certain students to come in and just use the machine at night. Only computer anywhere that could be used at any speed. And the diode matrix for the read-only control element was exposed, and some of the people used it at night realized they could change instructions by moving diodes around. No one said anything until one morning they didn't put the diode back in the right place. And after that, some of the first discipline was introduced, like no more of that. The storage then was storage tube. There are two kinds of storage tubes. A Williams tube that most people are using, IBM started using, and many others, which is an ordinary 5-inch cathode ray tube with a conductive plate on it, and it almost worked okay. The MIT approach was very elaborate. I'm not sure it worked much better. It had about a 7-inch bottle. It was a cylinder with two guns, one going directly in and one coming in at an angle, and a plate with beryllium faceplate on it, and this beautiful piece of glass blowing. And there were two of these in each. They stored 256 bits. Almost never were they all working. and there were two of those per digit, and that was as much as people thought you'd ever use in a computer. Jay Forrester invented an idea for core memory. Ann Wang made a memory, a stepping register memory at Harvard. Jay Forrester figured out how to do selection in the cores, which was the secret of the core memory. It was not getting very far because you needed a regulated current source for every line. And that one has 32 by 32 lines twice. So I think it's 128 very well regulated current sources. And we built one with 2 by 2 that took 8 current sources, and multiplying that, the whole idea just stopped. I had built the Whirlwind D2A converter for displays, which use regulated currents in a simple switching mechanism. And so when I heard about the problem, I didn't know how cores memories worked. When they talked about three-dimensional memory, I thought it was a block of magnetic material. I just couldn't conceive of it. When I saw how it was, I realized we could do the same switching that we did with the D2A converter, and that's what we see here. And suddenly, the core memory took off. Digital, not many years ago, was making 4 billion cores a month and having girls in Taiwan string them with 3 wires each. There's 1,000 cores in each one of those stacks, and there's probably 16 bits in a parity. Now, Whirlwind had a different approach to strategy from everybody else in another way. There was, of course, nothing in school to help you in these things. We at MIT did fairly well. We did very well in developing the core memory for one reason. The Rad Lab at MIT during the war did a lot for radar. And when they started, they discovered that no one knew how to make magnets. And some of these old World War II physicists said, if there's another war, we're going to have a bunch of engineers on how to design magnets. And so every electrical engineer knew how to design magnets. Now, we didn't make microwave oven type magnets, but the theory went directly into the cores. Two things Whirlwind was different. Every other machine, there was 3 or 4 being built, were designed by professors. And professors have to make things complicated or they got nothing over their students. Nobody can do it to teach. Whirlwind was outside of the academic world and was doing it directly for the Air Force. It started in World War II and the problem went away when the war was over, but it was 1950 and it was almost working and it was no problem. So the people doing it made it as simple as possible. So we would hire retired television repairmen to do design and fix the thing. That made it much different from all the other machines. And then they were well-educated, but they didn't know how to use Boolean algebra. I mean, they understood Boolean algebra, but said that's not the way to design a computer. So it was designed as if it was a puzzle. And I think Bob Everett did most of that himself. And everybody else used Boolean algebra, with the result that they did their logic in several steps and very slow. And they put everything into every digit and reproduced it with the digits. So everyone is very complex. Whirlwind figured out as it was a puzzle. And every digit was very fast, logically very simple, and all the common things were put out once per register, so that it was much simpler than the Boolean algebra designs. This was, of course, one of the ideas we took with us at Digital, and I like to think that we were missionaries in teaching the world how to build computers, because in time, everybody was building things the Whirlwind way, and I like to think we were the ones that did it, that educated them. We freely always give credit. Almost everything we Haddon concept. We took from Whirlwind the design, design concepts and how we run an organization. When we started Digital, we started off with an idea that was key to Whirlwind. One of the bold things they did was design test equipment. You see the rack just on the other side of the post? There's these panels, 3.5 inches high, that contain logic elements, just a flip-flop, a gate, or something. And Whirlwind first built a large number of these and designed everything using them. Other people couldn't test what they build. So we set out building the equipment equivalent, and that's these things here. I'm not sure they're loose. They're probably screwed down. Yep. They don't trust us. The dark brown ones, by the way, were those that failed, that were damaged and weren't suitable for selling, and those ones were used in-house. The trademark on the side was our original trademark, a vertical DEC. It's a rather clever one. I stole it right from the cover of a magazine. Someone else's initials were there. In time, people call us Digital. We changed to Digital, and we took the digital blocks from another magazine cover. And now we can't remember the name of the magazine. I think it was Machine Design, and hopefully everybody remembers Digital. Our first computer, the Whirlwind, was bold in a way which you may never think of. Every computer had a console, everyone we knew. You sat in front of the console as if you were running a power plant. You know, you've seen these power plants with the consoles, and you look behind there and there's a row of meters, you see, so someone can sit there and look at the whole power plant sitting behind the console. So every computer was built like that. It was a desk with some controls on it, but there was nothing to look at on the other side. And I think I was the first one to realize that. There were often nice girls carrying things around, but but it was a terrible job taking all the wires from the computer over to the console. A real drag. So the first one we built, the Whirlwind of PDP-1, had a separate console. And it dawned on me, it doesn't make sense, because we don't have a panel of meters out there like the power plants have. So we built the console right in. IBM immediately followed us. PDP-1 was introduced without software. We never told anybody why. People thought we had the idea we'd build hardware and let the software come later on, or they thought we were hardware people and didn't know. The real truth was we contracted with some professors at MIT to do the software, and they never delivered. So we got the machine ready. We sold it without software, but we didn't explain why. I don't remember exactly which one, so those are common names now, some at Stanford, some at MIT. But I don't remember for sure who they were, so which of those people were those who promised us software? One time, the Atomic Energy Facility in Chalk River, Canada, sent us a list of equations, said, we'd like to have you hardwire these into a box so we can control an experimental pile we have. We said, we don't have anybody with that much energy and patience to wire up those equations. Gordon Bell said, I'll design a absolutely minimal computer. So we offered to sell it to them as if it was a production price, as if it was a production item at a production price. And they said, great, because we didn't know what the equations were anyway. And so we sold the first PDP-5 to Chalk River, and it ran their experimental pile. People laughed at us for a simple machine like that. They thought it was absolutely ridiculous. But in time, it started to sell. And it was not designed to do computing. I mean, it was too simple. It was just 12 bits long with almost no instructions and no addressing space. But some people didn't know enough, and they started computing with it. And then in time, the people who ridiculed us had to make one too. We had two competitors, CDC and SDS in California. No, three C's and CDC. Start over again. Computer Controlled in Framingham and Scientific Data Systems in California. And we knew they were building one to match. And they thought, well, they'd make one better. And the one thing, they made a classic mistake. We are always susceptible to it, too. The classic mistake is see something, say, I'll make one better than that. And the mistake is, don't forget, that guy is making one, too. And so they came out with one, and next 2 weeks later, the other guy came out with one, and 1 week later, we announced our PDP-8. And we way underpriced them, and it was $18,000, and just wiped them out completely. The lesson is, don't look at somebody else's product and say you do something better, unless you're really sure you can do better than what he's working on. Now, the PDP-8 was a copy of the Logic and PDP-5. It had new modules, small modules, new connector that made by Sylvania that was pioneered by IBM. I think it might have had some of our little integrated circuits. I don't remember what it had, our thick film circuits. We made some semiconductors and thick film circuits about then, and I think it had some of those. Other than that, the logic was just out of the PDP-5. But there were some other innovations which, to us, are important. If you notice, our machines are still look somewhat like military. We always try to be different. The TX-0 was a bold attempt to break away from the military look. Everything was that color. Gray hammer tone. That was an improvement over black wrinkle finish of World War II. And we tried a bold color of tan and brown. And that was bold colors. That was really weird. I'll tell you the story about that one. I got to quit, but let me. MIT sent me to IBM for 13 months. When I came back as a rescue cure, they let me work on transistor computer. Transistors were strange then. But I had no, couldn't hire anybody, and had no space. And I'd keep working the problem. I discovered that halls weren't space. So I moved the wall down. And then I traded that for bigger space in the basement. And somebody threatened to quit, and I grabbed hold of them. Somebody walked in, and nobody wanted them, a shortage of engineers. And I hired them. They realized there was a loophole then. They wouldn't let that happen again. Then I found a part of the basement that was a dirt floor. I'm not sure I should tell you the tricks. Anyway, I talked him into paving the floor. Then I talked him into putting blue tile down. When the boss saw that, they stopped that. And the walls were light colored. It's the military operation. Everything is kind of a yucky green. And I talked him into putting twice the fluorescent light level in that room. And they caught that after the fact and stopped that again. And then we built a computer, which was as modern as I could design. You may look kind of crude to you now, but it was as modern as I could think of then. And I placed it in the room, maybe a little bigger than this. We walk in the door, and there was the computer. A lot of space around it. The MTC computer we built before, we showed off how making it easier, to making it look easy, and that wasn't the right way. We decided it should be photographable. Meanwhile, there was a competitive computer built in another room, another group. They did it in a small room, gray hammer tone panels on relay racks on a crickety aluminum false floor, and there just was no room. Now, this kind of terrified some people that I was getting all these things done when they didn't really mean to get it done. I wasn't breaking the rules, but they didn't mean to get it done. But when the boss had visitors, guess where he brought them? He didn't bring them on the crickety aluminum false floor with the gray hammer tone panels. He brought down that machine in a beautiful room with twice the light level. I interrupt my thoughts, and I can't remember where I was. But some of the interesting things at TX-0, I mean, rather, the PDP-5, I'm getting confused, the PDP-8, was that for the first time, we decided I decided we're going to exploit the technology that goes in automobiles and the technology that goes in appliances. So I would go down to Zehrs or Leachmere Sales and just study every single appliance. They thought I was casing a joint. I could tell you how every dryer, every washing machine was put together. And the 8 incorporated many of these. You notice we had individual lights and everything we built before. That was behind a silkscreen panel. We even have rosewood formica panels on the side. The switches came from the bats on the switches came from a hot point clothes dryer. We put slide switches, which cost 6 cents each. Now, in computers, where things got to work, it was a bold idea to say, we'll put six cent switches in behind those toggles, and then drive to make them reliable. And that's what we did. The panel there is held together by those two lock switches. Now, we always had a lock switch to turn the computer off and on by key, but we needed two to hold the panel together. So we had to invent a new use, and that was to disconnect the panel. Now, and then the thing held together, and that's the start toward a modern computer. Now, the thing that nobody realized, everybody then had two switches, and no one ever knew why. Even the Japanese sent mini computers, they had two switches. Sometimes it was a switch with three positions, and no one ever knew there was the third and second switch were there just to hold the panel together. I only tell you my successes. I didn't really like the colored plastic on that. I thought that was a bit much. But I tolerated it. And it really helped sell them. That really was great. That really, I wasn't that bold, but everybody insisted on it. And it really attracted attention for us and the computers. We also used an ad, starting off in Scientific American, with a teddy bear sitting alongside of it. To show it was cuddly and easy to use. And so the teddy bear was the sign for the PDB-8. Thank you all for coming. We look forward to developing our museum, or collection. We don't want to use the word museum because we don't want to sound like we're in competition. But out of this, I hope you enjoy looking at these things, and we look forward to developing these in lobbies of all the other buildings we have. Thank you.
See if I can get this microphone to work. No? Yes? Thank you very much. There are some refreshments, I believe, and I hope you enjoy looking at the rest of the collection. Thank you.